Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this, you're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
So these are the five keys to doing your best work. I would also call them the five keys to thriving, but that's because I see best work and thriving is so intimately linked that they do the same thing.
Yeah.
Right. And so as a mnemonic, if you're listening, guys, it's IABCD. IABCD. Intention, awareness, boundaries, courage, and discipline. These are the five keys that when you really look at projects that are stuck, what I've noticed is that it's some combination of a not enough of one of those in the project, right? And I'm just going to call out for most of us creative people, it's actually courage and discipline that we need a lot more of. And I know I'm an army guy and you're going to think, yeah, that's great for you. But no, seriously, like the discipline to choose a limited number of things that you want to be masterful at, that's a discipline, right? And the discipline to set out the goals of doing that and then sort of establishing the boundaries, it takes a little bit of discipline to establish and keep boundaries. Like that's where so much of the magic happens. And I think whenever I get a chance to be, you know, that version of you at the party with the novel writer, what I always want to prompt people is just to think like, you know, take whatever project you're thinking about or maybe that you're stuck. And there's two questions I'd like to ask. One is, what's the smartest next step? And the second is, what's the most courageous next step?
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Charlie, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks so much for having me back. And I want to start with two other things. One, really appreciated an audience of one. It came out about the time that I was finishing Start Finishing. It's a really great book. And also, thanks so much for your contribution to the book. It was just so on point, man.
Yeah. Well, you have a new book out, Start Finishing, which you just alluded to, which we will get into in a lot of detail. But as you know from, you know, my previous conversations, we almost never start talking about the book. And it's interesting because I actually don't think we've had you as a guest since we became Unmistakable Creative. For some reason, maybe we did. I don't remember for some reason. I know that we definitely had you prior to the rebrand.
I'm not sure about that. I think it was 2013 or 2014. So
yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I wanted to start with was, where in the world did you grow up and what impact did where you grew up end up having on the choices that you've made with your life and your career and the direction your life has taken?
Oh, that's such a great question. So I grew up in Fort Smith, Arkansas, which is right on the western border of Oklahoma. If you have to place that about midway in the state. So it's about 100,000 people, and grew up poor, grew up multiracial. My dad is Black and Native, and my mom is white and Native. And that created all sorts of different tensions, as one might imagine, because Arkansas in the 80s was not the kindest place when it comes to some of those dimensions around being around poverty and race. And so that sort of informs a lot of my background, especially of what it means to be included and excluded and what it means to have to struggle harder than others and things like that. But I also was selected for gifted and talented programs earlier. And I had one of those fortunate misfortunes in that we were so poor that my mom was teaching in a preschool, but she couldn't afford daycare for me. And so I actually started daycare. I started preschool a lot earlier than I should have been, just sitting in the back of the room, absorbing everything. And so it turns out that I was actually, you know, learning and picking up language and picking up all the sort of things you would learn way young. And that just set me up to be in some of these programs, being selected for leadership programs and things like that. And so in many ways, it's kind of been ahead of my age group or peer group. And that maintained for a long time. So the other important thing is I grew up in a military family. So my dad raised, especially his two sons, me and my brother, like we are little soldiers, and we would get in trouble. And as opposed to, you know, the sit down talks or as opposed to, you know, him getting the belt out, it would be like, give me 20 pushups. So there you are, like 4 years old, you know, and that sort of language and that sort of precision of thought and expectations and things like that. That was just how we grew up. So of course I'm going to end up in leadership programs. Of course I'm going to end up as a Boy Scout. And of course, I'm going to be an Eagle Scout and go to West Point and then, you know, military. So those sort of things, it's this weird sort of thing. I look back on it now that I'm cresting 40 and I'm like, there were so many disadvantages that, that I started with. But in that struggle, in those disadvantages, emerged the things that ultimately made me successful.
So we'll get back to this whole idea of turning disadvantages into advantages, but I want to dig deeper into the whole mixed race thing. This is something I've always wondered about, is when people mix two different cultures, two different races together, what are the dynamics like? Like what part, you know, parts of each parent do you, you know, inherit? What sort of, you know, different views did they have? And, you know, like you said, particularly in the 80s where, you know, this wasn't as tolerant, because I had had that in my mind. I had a feeling that that was the case. I wasn't sure that you're, I knew that you were mixed race. I just didn't know which mix.
So, I
wonder, like, you know, what is that dynamic like, you know, between your parents? And then of course, you know, for their own parents, like, you know, your grandparents, like what did they, you know, how did they perceive this situation? You know, you get, you know, two people who are mixed race getting together at a time when that, you know, it's not as common as it is today.
Yeah. I think what I want to start with is I get super frustrated when we try to encapsulate a race or peoples in sort of a monolithic culture, right? And so when you look at, say, Black folk who live in the South, it's a different culture. It's a different narrative than sort of Black folk who live in the Pacific Northwest, which is where I currently live. And so I at least want to start with saying that it's going to depend on your region and it's going to depend upon the time. Again, 1980s is a really important thing. In my particular context, you know, my dad, who presents as Black and considers himself Black, even though he has Native blood, that's a whole other conversation, right? His family accepted my white mother, but it was still one of those, she's an outsider that has become an insider, which is different than her being an insider, like for the entire life, or because she's, you know, she doesn't get invited to the cookout because she's already at the cookout, you know? And so that was a big tension in there. And so, you know, we had, unfortunately, I think a lot of unproductive conversations about race and stereotypes between my mom and dad talking about it. But the thing about, you know, when you really look at racism in a broad sort of complex version, like people can be, and we don't like talking about this, but people can be racist or they can have bias against their own race, right? We don't talk about that nearly as much as we should, right?
Right. You talk to any Indian person, they'll be like, yeah, Indians are cheap.
You know? Yeah.
Like, and all Indians will be like, well, that stereotype kind of exists because we've seen evidence of it.
Yeah.
Even though it's not necessarily unanimously true.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you get that. So, you know, just the narratives we had about race. And so over on my mom's side, my father or my maternal grandfather was actually at least half Cherokee. We think Cherokee. And my maternal grandmother was Irish. And but even though there was that sort of thing, my maternal grandmother ended up being rather racist and very explicit about it towards my dad. And so, you know, in the total context, what mixed people like me will often feel, or I won't speak for other mixed people, I'll speak for myself here. I felt like I was an outsider no matter what I did, because neither race, you know, especially in the South, because there's really only like Black folks, right? At the time, there's like white people, Black people, and then everybody else, right? And so in the whole one drop rule legacy and things like that, like you were either white or you were Black. Well, here you have this mixed kid who's neither, but both, right? Yeah. And so you're always sort of walking this line with sort of Black culture, like, are you Black enough? Are you sort of like presenting as Black, but you're really not Black? Are you too Black? Like, you know, are you like, so you're always sort of being that, and you can get ejected from sort of Blackness. Like that card could be taken away from you pretty quickly. Right. And then on the sort of the white side of things, it's like, obviously with your skin in the South, you cannot be white. Right. And it ends up in really weird things, because even at the time with all the sort of nerdy academic stuff that I was doing, given the way that sort of micro society was set up, all of my friends were white. Which means all of my sort of dating pool were also white, right? So for me, to like actually date a black girl and marry a black girl, I would have had to leave my friend and peer group to specifically seek out, you know, someone that's not in that. And that's just not the way that we date and mate, you know? And so the legacy of that is, again, I'm 40 years old. I'm very much into equality and advancing. Well, I won't go into that yet unless we go there. But at the same time, there's just oddity. It's like, but yo, you're white. Your wife is white. And I'm like, one, let's really unpack what you're saying to me. And two, let's look at this context where, you know, for me, you know, I live in Portland, Oregon right now. Portland's got a lot of great things going on, but massive diversity, not so much.
And so
it's the same sort of thing when I'm like, how do I only have like two or three black friends? But it still goes with what audience am I in? What's my context for my work? And Serena, you and I both know like the path of authorship is not one that's like really rich in diversity.
I'm looking at my wall of fame right now that, you know, I have frame prints of all the people that many of the people I've interviewed on my wall. Yeah. Only one of them is not Caucasian.
Yeah,
now that I'm looking at it, which is really strange. You know, now that you mentioned it, I never have noticed that before. And it's funny that you say that because even in the process of writing my previous book, you know, my agent was a woman, is a woman. My writing coach is a woman, and my editor is a woman. And we went through the first, you know, draft, and we submitted it. And there was a section where, you know, because I mean, you know, the sort of nonfiction book structure of, hey, make your point and support it with examples is kind of, you know, constantly what you're going through. And I remember we got the first round of comments back, and my editor Stephanie says, she's like, "Do you realize that every single example that you gave in this section is a white male?"
Mm-hmm.
And what struck me as so funny about that is, you know, we're back to that whole idea of bias. I said, "How is it that two women and an Indian guy completely overlooked that?"
Yeah, because I knew about that going into Start Finishing, I selectively, like if you look at the epilogues, if you look at everything, I was like, I'm not doing that, right? There are plenty of great thinkers. There are plenty of other folks that I don't need to be another person talking, like frontlining my book with Peter Drucker. I don't need to be another person with Stephen Covey. There's nothing wrong with Peter Drucker, Stephen Covey, and all the rest. I'm not saying that at all, but it goes back to our, you know, one of our previous conversations, maybe in the green room, was like, what am I doing? I've got this moment with this book to showcase different thinkers and to showcase a perspective of thought, which is one of the reasons I asked for contributions, right? Uh-huh. And it's like, I'm going to take that moment and be super intentional about it so that maybe the next person that writes a book can see like, oh, wait a second. Like there's an example of someone that does that. And it actually gets even worse, Srini, because nominally my book is in sort of the productivity shelf. Right now there are like three like non-white, non-male people who write about productivity. You know, it's a really small set of folks that write, you know, that are going to be on the bookshelf. And there may be a lot of self-published books, nothing wrong with that. But if you go to Barnes and Noble, you look at how this game is structured, it's a really small group of folks. And so, yeah, it ended up in this sort of weird thing. And so going back to my previous point, it's like the advantage of growing up mixed in the South is that you learn how to be a social chameleon, social chameleon, how to blend in with different people, how to present, how to do all those types of things. It's a coping mechanism. It's a negotiation tactic. It's all the sort of things. And so you can sort of swim in any audience and be fine with it. You know, the military helps with that as well. But at the same time, there's also, for me, that sadness when I walk into the room and it confirms that yet again, I'm one of three out of 300 people. You know, it gets old.
So it's funny because I think that if you look at the history of black people in America, which, you know, we had a lot of people here, particularly recently, like Desiree Attaway, a guy named Chris Wilson, who, you know, had this amazing story about the books that saved his life while he was in prison. And you know, we talked about this extensively. We had, you know, Sean Dove here, who runs the campaign for Black Male Achievement. Like, you know, some really, really extraordinary people and stories that I honestly had never really heard, but understanding, you know, sort of where they're coming from and how the communities that they are brought up in are, you know, like they are out of the gate with a lot of disadvantages. And so I think about this, you know, from two perspectives, right? Because like, you know, you look at the sort of stereotype of Indians minus the comedic act of, you know, oh yeah, 7-Elevens, motels, and you know, being cheap, the other stereotype is, oh, these guys are the ones who run Silicon Valley, you know, yep. Like they're the doctors and engineers and you know, all of that. And so the reason, you know, I mentioned this is it's funny because I myself never really have thought about race in that way. This is the example that came to my mind, and I wanted to ask you about this. And I may have mentioned this on the air before, so forgive me for those of you who heard this, but given what we're talking about, I did a TEDx talk sometime, you know, probably 2-3 years ago, like right around the time Unmistakable came out. You know, we needed to get video of me speaking, and so I did a TEDx talk. And I remember the first slide deck that I did for this TEDx talk, and I get feedback from the Speakers Bureau that they're not upset, but concerned because all the pictures of the kids that were in my speakers talk were all white. I was like, well, doesn't it matter that it was an Indian guy on stage? Who cares if kids in the slides are white? But it's weird because I would have never, like, that just never crossed my mind to think about that. And, you know, I wonder, like, dude, you know, like, I just wanted to kind of, you know, air this out with you because we're on the subject.
Yeah, so I completely get that. And especially, I think it's part of our age group because we grew up in sort of that colorblind race people, like, I don't see color, I see people sort of scenario, which, yeah. And there are many reasons we accept that. And especially if you're coming from, I don't know what the immigrant status is of your parents and things like that, but sort of the thing is you want to assimilate and not be different as much as possible. And you don't want to treat people differently because you don't want to be treated differently. Right. Mm-hmm. And so we sort of grew up in that pocket to where in many ways we were discouraged from talking about it, from saying like, yo, why does your screen full of white people when it could be full of other people? You're talking about the human experience, not just the monolithic white experience. Right. But we weren't, that wasn't a conversation that was happening in the 80s, right? It took me until my mid early 20s to really realize the rich history of Black intellectualism that exists in our nation, simply because I couldn't walk into a library in Arkansas and find, you know, 6 books of James Baldwin, or I may have been able to find it, but I had to be able to find that myself pre-internet, pre-internet. So, where I am now is like, if you go to Productive Flourish and you look at some of our lead banners, you look at our products, you look at them, I'm like, yo, we are not going to continue this thing where we're not thinking about who's on these graphics. We can find just as many, if we're going to use a stock photo, find a stock photo of a person of color. Yeah. If we're going to use that, if we're going to be talking about a subject that seems to be so like dude bro, let's find an appropriate picture of a woman and include her in this conversation, because frankly, you know, the productivity conversation is so masculine to start with, right? And so dominated by men. This is where I love people's work like Laura Vanderkam and Neen James and folks like that, because they're bringing in this for the rest of the population who, for good reasons, don't really give a crap about 17 ways to hack a shoebox. Like, that's not really... That's not really what they're interested in, because they're doing other things that our society is placed on. So anyways, so I'm just intentional about that now. I'm not demanding that other people do that, but I'm sort of actively thinking about how do we create the world that we want to see?
Yeah.
And part of that is I feel like I have a responsibility and a privilege and an opportunity to, you know, if the medium is the message and we marketers get to present the world a certain way, like, let's take advantage of that and present the world closer to how it actually is than just continuing this innocent, innocent, unconscious way of presenting the status quo.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I appreciate that so much, because I think you echo in a lot of ways my own purpose and mission with what we do here. I mean, the sheer diversity of voices and views that we try to bring in. And we are always looking for that constantly. It's, you know, I think it was funny because I remember my friend Erica Learmark once, I told her, I said, you know, every time I have a female guest, the downloads go up. And she said, yeah, of course they do. She's like, because we talk to each other and we're more social. And I remember I said, great, let's do an entire month where we feature nothing but female guests. And we did. And she basically filled that pipeline. And our audience grew a lot during that time. And, you know, it's funny because I've been meaning to do that again. But yeah, I mean, I think that was one of those things that we always made a point to try to balance it out, you know, from gender, from race, and mix it up as much as possible.
Yeah. And I would also throw in, like, you know, I know part of unmistakable creative is about entrepreneurship, but the other thing that I try to do on our podcast, Productive Flourishing, I'll just sort of seed this if I may, Srini. And yeah, I know you please. Do it, but just let's focus on stories of people in the struggle, or maybe focus of, you know, stories of failure. Like, let's tell the real entrepreneurial experience as opposed to just what's on Fast Company and Inc. and what's in Startup Culture, right? Because we know that's at best 3%, and it's not the type of bootstrapping, creative hustling that many of us are out and about. So that's the other thing, is like, let's show this full diversity there.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, one thing that was, you know, that became very important to me at a certain point, it was to give voice to things that I felt needed a bigger voice. You know, it's funny, there's a guy who gave a TED talk who's an ex-MS-13 gang member. Unfortunately, I haven't gotten a response from him. And I was like, for the love of God, I'm like, please come and talk to us. I really want to hear your story. He has a TED talk. And I was like, oh my God, like, this is amazing. I need to talk to this guy. You know, and the thing is, it's giving voice to things that may not have a voice. Whereas, you know, what you see on the covers of magazines, it's like, okay, do they really need any more coverage? You know, that is one of those things where it's like, oh, for them, it's just a nice to have, because they're already in a situation where that's going to happen regardless. One thing that, you know, I wonder is, how old were you when you started to recognize these racial dynamics? Because, you know, having grown up in Texas, you know, I kind of have an idea of what your sort of childhood is like. And I think that there was a time when I would not have said that I was proud to be Indian. And then it went to like the opposite extreme. By the time I got to college, I found that, you know, in a place like Berkeley, because you had such huge populations of every ethnicity, it was very easy to be ethnocentric and gravitate towards your own kind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I was 6 or 8 years old. I actually wrote about this on Medium a couple of years ago. And then I got out of the public conversation about politics and sort of race at that time, because of 2016, and that might be another conversation. But it was really, I'm trying to make a long story very short here. My middle oldest sister, when she would come down to visit, she's my half sister. And even at those age, she'd be like, are you black or are you white? You know, posing that to a 6 or 8 years old, and like, you had to choose. And so what I told her then, I was so smart enough to say, like, neither and both. That's all that's it. That's what I got for you. Right. Yeah. And that wasn't the right answer, because at the time I felt, now, you know, I haven't had a conversation, adult conversations with her about that, but that's neither here nor there. But at the time, I sort of felt like I was being asked to choose which of the two arcs I was going to go along and sort of choose and claim that identity. And I can't speak for other people's experience, but my sort of relationship with my own racial identity is one, like, just like people can be gender fluid. I think I can be racially fluid, in the sense that sometimes, like I did in this, I'll say I'm multiracial, and sort of that depends upon what it is. And then other times I'm just straight up black, you know? Yeah. But when I wake up in the morning, and I know some people of color have that, right, where they wake up in the morning, they look in the mirror and they see that person. Like, you might see an Indian person. You might see that being reflected back to you. I don't. It's not until I walk outside and I realize the broader social context, like, oh yeah, I need to remember that I'm a black man in this world and orient as such. And when I write online, like, that's a part of my consciousness, because when I'm in a public space, like, identity, especially when you're talking about racial, gender, you know, sort of these types of identities, they're socially maintained things.
Yeah.
And so it's like, much like you might not call your partner by your pet names that you call her in the house, right? Once you leave, like, you don't necessarily with new people use those pet names in public, but there's no agreement. You don't consciously say, you know, I'm not going to call her Pookie when I'm out at dinner. Right. Mm-hmm. You just don't. And so it's that same sort of thing. Like, you step into that context, that public sphere, and you recognize that double consciousness of your race. And it gets even trickier, because again, if I'm going in public, and I might be going to something to support people of color, I'm like, oh, in this context, I've got to do, even myself, I've got to do some code switching to be myself, but I would say a different version of myself than I was before I walked into that room.
Wow. Wow. Well, let's do this. Speaking of walking into the room, you know, I think I do want to spend a little bit of time talking about your military background, because I think it is actually such a perfect segue into the content in the book. Talk to me about how, your time in the military has informed and shaped the work that you do today and who you've become after you came out. And in addition to that, what, for those of us who are not on the front lines, who pretty much all we see is basically a government who spends too much money on war, like, you know, I saying this as a, you know, Berkeley graduate liberal hippie, what am I misunderstanding? Because you've been in the front lines, you've been there in a way that I never will.
Yeah. So you want me to answer the latter one?
The second question the latter. First? Let's start with the latter first, because that's a broader sort of military question.
Yeah. What you're missing is a lot in the sense of, yes, the government. Well, here's what I'll say. I agree with you. Government does spend too much money fighting wars that we don't need to be in and doing things we don't need to. And in my perspective, not spending enough money in places we actually need to be. Right. And that's a whole sort of geopolitical military conversation there. Yeah. But I think you're missing people who truly sign up because they want to make their country better. They want to contribute more so than just paying taxes and voting to the preservation of this nation that they love. Yeah. And so I, you know, it's one of the reasons I joined. I actually joined the National Guard and then got activated and federalized and became a U.S. Army soldier, which that's a whole different thing. But, you know, my whole thing was like, this place that I live, I love, and I want to be a part of its endurance and prosperity and defense if need be. I grew up in Arkansas. It's in Tornado Alley. I joined the National Guard because I'm like, you know, tornadoes are going to come, floods are going to happen, and I want to be one of the people moving sandbags and driving people and, you know, all those types of things. And people who join the active duty military, like, I want to be one of those people who can look back at my life and say, I contributed in that way. Okay. Yeah. So, but the other thing that you have to sort of think about, and many people who are haven't been big in sports don't get this, is you end up, in my view, Serenity, I'll send you a link about this because you might find it interesting, because I did try to explain this in this post. You end up in this pre-industrial society, or in a society that operates on pre-industrial codes where everybody counts. Mm-hmm. Everybody has everybody's back. You live with folks. You eat with folks. You work with folks. It's a 24/7 lived immersive experience, and you develop really tight bonds with the people around you, even if they're temporary.
Yeah.
And it's super hard to go back into a very isolated, a very individualistic, a very unfocused civilian society and cope with that. Because you're used to, like, when I deployed, his name is Eric McCoy, love Cheese Mac. Anyways, Eric McCoy, he's a lieutenant with me, stayed in the same tent. And it's one of those things, and I'll just tell a little micro story here. Like, we would get off duty. We had similar duty shifts, and we would play Halo, the original Halo on the original Xbox for like 3 or 4 hours on stupid hard mode. Half the time, the damn Xbox would die because it would get sand and overheat. And so we'd have to start that whole checkpoint all over again. But then the next morning, we'd go to bed about the same time after just hanging out. The next morning, we would get up at about the same time because we lived in a damn tent with each other. We'd get up, grab all of our shower stuff, walk down, take a shower with each other, walk back to chow hall, then walk back to our duty stations. At lunch, we'd find each other, go to lunch, then come back, right? And then, you know, after we had that final meal, we would go back and we'd start that all over again.
Yeah.
You do that for a year, right? And you develop these really tight bonds. You talk about everything, and there's just so many unsaid things. And what I really say, especially about men, because of the ways that we socialize men, you can't have that relationship outside of environments like that. And I find that there's a deep longing amongst us men, amongst us sort of thriving men, to have those sort of tight bonds. But the thing is, we redeployed. Eric lived less than a quarter mile away from me.
Wow.
Right? He lived less than a quarter mile away from me, which is about as far as we would walk for our duty stations anyways.
Yeah.
Immediately once that happened, I started seeing him once every 2 weeks, once every 4 weeks, once every 6 weeks, because we had our lives, we had everything going on, but we both had that sort of like, hey, when are we getting good? And so, you know, you have to re-acclimatize to being in normal civilian life. And then you got your partners, you got your jobs, you got your work. And you're like, but what about that buddy routine that I had where we were just so in the pocket together? Mm-hmm. Right. And so there's that aspect that I think a lot of civilians don't get, is that's what, like, the politics and all the bullshit, like it's there. You know that that's in there when you're in there, but it's the people that keep you there. And it's that culture and that sense of service where you're just like, this is what I'm meant to do. I can't imagine doing anything else. And also I'm really good at it because they've trained me to be really good at it. And I have one thing to do, Srini. Like I, as an officer, I had like one major job. Everything else was covered. I didn't have to be this generalist doing all the things that I got to do as an entrepreneur, right? So it's super focused, hard, but focused. So there's all those sort of things that I think you miss, that sense of service, that sense of belonging, that sense of community, fraternity, that sense of mastery that is just so hard to get in. Oh, one last thing.
Yeah.
The skill tree, right? You knew what you needed to do to get that next promotion. You knew what courses you need to take. You knew what staff positions you needed. You knew how to check those block into advance in a way that, Srini, it took me like 3 or 4 years to sort of think, like, wait a second. I may not be sort of training for the expert infantry badge anymore, but I can create that same sort of thing for my business. Why not? Right? And I can use that if I want to be there. Here's what I need to have in place. And use that to backwards. Because once you enter the no man's land of entrepreneurship and once your business sort of takes a certain point, like there's just an infinity of choices and you can choose any of them and you don't know where the hell you're going, right?
Absolutely.
So it's probably more than you wanted on that, but there's just so much there.
That is fantastic. I was fortunate enough to get to do a talk with a nonprofit that trains retired special forces guys how to transition into civilian careers. One of our listeners runs this amazing group called the Station Foundation. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I think the thing that struck me the most about what they were struggling with this transition was exactly what you just said, that this sense of community that they had built. Like, you know, I have a friend, Brian Ferguson, who's, you know, surfer, snowboarder. And he said, once you go through that experience of SEAL training together, he said, it's just, you go into a workplace and the bonds are like, they just, you know, they seem like pathetic in comparison. He's like, it's just not possible to recreate that. And he said, and that is often one of the biggest challenges of transitioning back to civilian life.
It absolutely. I mean, just, and you know, there's... The other thing that I would say is the type of relationships where, like, if we were buddies in the military and you were doing something that wasn't, you weren't doing your best or you were morally slipping or things like that.
Yeah.
There's a very quick conversation about that. Right. Like, and, you know, depends upon how radio friendly we want to make this podcast, but it'd be like, Srini, you're slipping up, fix it. Right. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. And like, dude, I know that I'm not like, I, you know, and just fix it. Don't care. Don't have time for the drama. Fix it yesterday. Mm-hmm. And it's like, got it. And then people can start changing. So I think there's also this culture of excellence, both personal. Well, I mentioned the professional, but also personal excellence. And, you know, unfortunately, people, I think, see soldiers as sort of dumb trigger pullers. And like, why would any reasonably smart person do that sort of whatnot? But when you really look at it as a more broad thing, some of the smartest people you will ever meet, I'm not putting myself in that group, but I'm just saying other folks like are in the military.
Oh, yeah. I mean, right? We've had some of those guests, people like Chris Fussell, who's, you know, wrote the book with Stanley McChrystal. I mean, it was, yeah. I mean, some of those people are brilliant.
Brilliant and know more about the world than most people. Like, I'm still trained, Srini. We're hanging out here more than you probably wanted, but I'm still trained. That when I see news, especially geopolitical news, I can start to think about the regional aspects of what's going on there, the geopolitical footprint, the strategy being on. So like whole thing going on with Turkey, I can't turn that off to start thinking about, in case you didn't know, Turkey got some anti-aircraft missiles that's really made NATO concerned and made the United States pissed off because it exposes vulnerabilities of the F-35 fighter jet. Now, why does that matter? Because Turkey historically is a geopolitical hotbed in things. And so I can't not see that. Right. But there, and I'm 10 years out of being this, being an officer, but there are people that are looking at that every day. They're reading Foreign Affairs. They're reading BBC. They're watching Al Jazeera. They're looking at policies coming down. They're deeply involved in, you know, DOD strategy and US strategy. And so, yes, there's a lot of folks with heart. Yes, there's a lot of folks out there just getting it done. But also some of our smartest, most creative people are actually in the Department of Defense.
Yeah. Well, I've basically, you know, rattled your ear off for a good, you know, 30 minutes without letting you talk about your book. So, you know, I think that, but I think it actually was a perfect setup for it, given that, you know, like I said, once I realized the military background, suddenly everything about the way you see all of this makes a lot of sense. What prompted this book? Like, of all the books you could write, why this one?
Because so many of us creative people love talking about big ideas and strategy and, you know, the vision of the future. And we struggle with the same damn thing about getting stuff done. Like, we have the ideas and we can't get it done. And so many people keep coming to me, like, I want to be able to do these big ideas. I want to be able to push them forward. Mm-hmm. And I want to, you know, let's talk about strategy. And I'm like, honestly, I don't think you need to talk about strategy. I think you need to talk about execution, right? I think you need to talk about getting it done, right? Yeah. Because if you show up to me today and you're 120% overcommitted, mm-hmm. I can't add anything to that. Like, wow, let's talk about getting you down to 80%. So maybe we can add something to it. But it was just one of those things where people kept wanting to go over this stuff around it. And more importantly than that, though, I think people miss the connection between thriving mm-hmm. and doing what matters most.
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of people are frustrated and yearning because we get to the end of the week or the month or the quarter or the year, and you're like, I've been that rocking chair. That's a lot of motion, but no progress. And I'm frustrated. Right. Yeah. And so we only have, as far as we know, like this one short life to live. And I want us to take the full advantage of it, which means there's just a lot of stuff that we have to kick off the plate and say, you know what, this is the thing that I'm going to do. And that terrifies, frustrates, and angers a lot of creative folks because they don't mm-hmm. want to make that choice. But by not making that choice, they're also choosing not to thrive in a really significant way.
Yeah. I think that, you know, one of the things that struck me was you opened this book, the book, about this idea of living in a project world, and you basically describe projects as mirrors and bridges. And then you also talked about this sort of 3 to 5 year, you know, sort of reinvention that constantly occurs. Can you go into more detail about that?
Yeah. So project world is just basically the idea that we live in 3 to 5 year time slices, professionally and personally. So it takes us 3 to 5 years to find someone that we actually think we might want to marry and then marry them. That could be a year. Or then we have kids that, you know, go through different stages in about 3 to 5 years, moving across country, going to school. We have just a series of projects that are 3 to 5 years long. Then professionally, we have similarly, like, you take a job, your first 3 to 5 years of that job, you're sort of in one position, then hopefully you move on to another position. Maybe you take another job. Project world is just the idea that that is the norm. We no longer live in what I call career world, where, you know, you go to college and then you work at a company for 20, 25 years. They give you a pin, you move to Florida and retire and play golf for the rest of your life. Like, that world arguably never existed, but at least that was the myth. No one I know that's our age or younger thinks that we're going to retire at the same company we start working at. Like, it's just, what? Like, yeah. And I only get to work at one company, by the way. Mm-hmm. Anyways. And so the grace of project world is that when we're so gripped with, you know, are we making the best choice about, you know, what type of person I want to be when I grow up, it sort of loosens that up and says, you know, you're really just making a choice for the next 3 to 5 years of your life. And whether you fail, guess what? It's going to be 3 to 5 years. If you succeed, it's going to be 3 to 5 years, and then you'll move on to something else, right? That's the grace of it. But the downside of it is that you got to ship. You got to, by ship, I mean taking whatever ideas that you have, turning mm-hmm. them into something that's useful for other people, some yep. sort of marketplace, whether the marketplace or your colleagues, marketplace like the consumer marketplace or whatever. You got to ship. Because you can't say, well, I've been spending 3 to 5 years sort of working on this thing, but I don't have anything really to show you, right? Mm-hmm. You immediately, like, lose credit. Like, no one's going to hire you. It's like, so you've been working on this 3 to 5 years and you can't, like, show me any result. You can't show me any deliverable. You can't show me how you made the world different
right.
and better in that time.
Uh-huh.
Like, that, you can't do it, you know?
Well, it's funny you say that. Sorry.
Go ahead.
I was at a party once and, you know, some girl tells me that she's been working on a novel for 3 to 5 years, like, really smart girl. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, you've been working on this for 3 to 5 years in a vacuum. And I was like, why has it taken 3 to 5 years? And she said, you know, you can't just sit down and write. And I remember my content strategist, King Shook, he says to me, he's like, yeah, you're the wrong person to say that to. And
absolutely.
And I look at her and I'm like, okay, I know I've just met this person, but whatever. I was like, that is complete bullshit. It was totally obnoxious and rude. And then I thought back to this Stephen King quote. He said, you know, if you want to be a writer, your days as a member of polite society are numbered anyways. But yeah, that's why I you know, it's funny you said that, but back to you, mirrors and bridges.
Yeah. So projects are mirrors because they reflect what's going on internally and what's going on in your world. And, you know, when I wrote the book, I really wanted people to latch on to one idea and sort of work through the strategies, insights, and practices mm-hmm. with that one idea. Yeah. Because if you choose a project that really matters with you, matters to you, and you actually follow the process, a bunch of stuff is going to come up, man. Uh-huh. Like all of your self-doubts, all of your sort of inner critic, all of this, what I call head trash, is going to come up, but only if you hang on to that project. Because what we too often do, Srini, and you've experienced this too, is like when it gets hard, we bail to the next thing mm-hmm. until it gets hard, and then we bail to the next thing. And so like when you bail to the next project, you're automatically going to figure out something that you hadn't figured out in the other one. Like you can't run away from yourself mm-hmm. because you're always going to be there.
Yeah.
And so the mirrors, because if you choose the right project, it's going to reflect what's going on internally and externally. Mm-hmm. And they're bridges because they build the world that you want to be in, right? Yeah. That future, like, so we creative people, we have this really tentative relationship with reality mm-hmm. because on the one hand, we realize we have to operate within the constraints of reality as we know them now, mm-hmm. but we're always creating that new matrix of possibilities that become the reality, mm-hmm. become the next reality. Yeah. And so we have to use projects as bridges. And so whether that's, you know, creating a kick-ass podcast like Unmistakable Creative, whether that's, you know, starting a nonprofit, like you got to do the work to create that new reality mm-hmm. because ideas by themselves do not create a new reality.
Well,
they don't.
I think, you know, what prompted you to reach out to me was that piece that I wrote either on Facebook or on blog, I put it in both places. It was like, nobody gives a shit what you're going to start. And yet, you know, you look at your Facebook newsfeed, I mean, every day there are announcements of all the things that people are going to start. But, you know, one of the things that, you know, I wanted to reference this, you know, Sam Altman is a president of Y Combinator, has a blog that he occasionally writes on. And when he does, it's always just stellar. There's something that, you know, we're talking about projects, and this has stayed with me all week long. And I keep thinking about it because, you know, he says that I always, you know, he said, I'm willing to take as much time as needed between projects to find my next thing. But I always want it to be a project that, if successful, will make the rest of my career look like a footnote.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, being the president of Y Combinator, maybe that's a luxury you have when you're, you know, that well off or whatever it is. But I wonder, as somebody who has written a book about sort of projects, how do you think about, I mean, what is your response to that? Like, how do you think about what Sam says in that post?
Yeah, I need to back up real quick, but then I'll answer that. Sure. To me, a project is anything that requires time, energy, and attention to complete. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason I want to make it super broad like that is because so often when we're talking about projects and productivity and getting stuff done, we're just looking at economic work.
Yeah.
Right. We're not looking at the sort of what we might want to call life or personal work of mm-hmm. raising kids and building better communities and, you know, being a secretary at your church or whatever that might be. I also count that as a project. I also count that as work worth doing. And so I say that just because I think part of what we think about when we're thinking about sort of project world is what's my next career focus? And that mm-hmm. becomes what we look at, as opposed to what type of human do I most want to be in the world? Yeah. And what are the projects that manifest that human? Mm-hmm. I think making your previous work a footnote is challenging, but what I would say is, what are you working on that's going to matter 2 years from now?
Yeah.
Right. What are you going to work on 5 years from now, 10 years from now? Right. Because I think, you know, one of my coaching questions when people are curious about working with me is like, you know, let's imagine that it's the end of a year, or 12 months from now. Right. Let's say that we can only be celebrating three things. Mm-hmm. You know, we're kicking back beers or whatever it is. What are those three things? And you only get those three things. Mm-hmm. Right. Because it focuses what you have done or what you have focused. And it's like, so how do we structure your days? How do we structure your work? How do we structure your projects so that we get those three? Yeah. Because if we don't, what we're going to get to is a year from now, we're going to be talking about all the stuff that you're maybe working on or thinking about, but not the stuff you've done. Right. And so that's the sort of guiding perspective that I want to give people. And when I talk mm-hmm. a little bit about you know, choosing projects. And I got this from Stuart Brand.
Yeah, I saw that.
But I got it by way of Kevin Kelly, by way of Tim Ferriss. So
it's funny because that was one of my, that was sort of my next question was, okay, I wanted to ask you about the Stuart Brand quote. And I was like, okay, could I write a blog post about this? But apparently not.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You probably could write a blog, but I don't know. But
of course, but yeah.
Yeah, you have to find it. But the basic idea, Stuart Brand said, you know, I mean, a significant project is going to take at least 5 years to see through. Now, he wrote that well after I'd been talking about Project World for a few years. So, but when I saw it, I was like, yes, Stuart Brand is the founder of the Long Now Project, which tries to imagine where humanity is going to be in 10,000 years, right? And making decisions for the 10,000 year perspective. Because really long thinking, really thinking about where we're going. And so, you know, sort of captured that and is like, okay, so I'm going to take you up on that, Stuart. Let's go one step further. Let's subtract your age from 85, right? Then divide that by five. Mm-hmm. That's as many significant projects as you can have for the rest of your life. So I might have 9.
Yeah.
Right? That's all I can do. Unless I really get busy and maybe, like for me, you know, I'm on my second book, my first real full length book. I know folks that are shipping them out every year and things like that. But I know for me, with the way I have my life set up, a book is one of those 5-year projects, right? Mm-hmm. I don't like it, but that's just the reality of it. I got to choose to do something else so that it's not a major project. But, you know, whether it's that business, whether it's that nonprofit, whether it's your kids, like you only have so many projects left. And this really, I think this is one of those things that as I've talked to people about it, there's like a knot in their stomach. It feels like the world is just pressing on their chest. Like, oh my God, I only have 9 things left to do. But I'm saying, let's accept that as a premise. Does the work that you're working on now merit being one of those 9 things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if not, maybe switch it up. What does need to be on it?
Yeah. Well, I think that you know, it's funny. I didn't want to get to this yet, but you mentioned what you call the 5 projects rule. And I was looking kind of, you know, I use Notion to manage all of my projects and I was looking at it and I thought, yeah, you know what? I know very clearly, like we're planning an event that is happening in February or in April of 2020. There's the podcast and then there's, you know, sort of ancillary stuff around the podcast, like our animated shorts and all of that. And then there's writing. And I'm like, okay, you know what? Like it's funny because I remember somebody once, Glenn Beck, actually, of all people, told me, he said, you know, you think of it as like a hub and spoke model, your podcast, the radio is the hub. Everything else is basically spokes. And, you know, and I thought about it and it's funny because I started diving back into Scott Belsky's action method because I was looking for a quote and I ended up rereading the entire book. And then, you know, it's funny because now I'm like, okay, I can cobble pieces of your system and his together in a way that works for me. But it's like when I looked at it, I thought, okay, you know what? Yeah, there are probably 3 projects here. It's a lot easier to move each one forward when you're not working on that many of them. Although I have one project that I've been stuck on. So we'll get to that because I want to see what advice you have for me.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So go back. Let's go to 5 projects rule.
So 5 projects rule. So the really nerdy way that only I will say is it's really no more than 5 active projects per time perspective. Hmm. So let me sort of cash that out. So what, Serena, you just mentioned, you have at the year-long perspective or the yearly perspective, you have 3, right? 3 major projects. Yep. And then we'll talk about the one that's probably in a tar pit, but we'll come back to that.
Yep.
Now, we can also say this month, what are your 3 to 5 major month size projects? And in the work that I've done, Serena, like, though we can get around, we can get wrapped in the axles around whether it's 23 hours or whether it's 28 hours, or, you know, something like that. Like most people intuitively know what a month size project looks and feels like.
Yeah.
Right. About how far they can get in a month. Even though we're terrible at estimating how long something takes, even though it always takes longer than we think it's going to take, we still sort of know intuitively the difference between a month size project and a week size project. Right. And so that per time slot or per time perspective just says, you know what, when you're doing your monthly planning and you're sort of thinking about what matters most for this month, don't think about all of the, you know, chores, all of the little nits and nets. Just go back to that same sort of question I ask is like at the end of this month, what are the no more than 5 projects that I want to make significant progress on? And how do I chunk them down such that I can say I shipped something or you can show your work or there's some meaningful piece of that. So it just helps with that chunking, but it really helps with 2 other things besides that, right? Prioritization, because again, it goes down like, is whatever you're working on, would you choose for that to be one of your 5 projects?
Yeah.
If not, why not? Right? What do you need to do about that? But I think it also helps us be more human with ourselves because when we have that feeling like, man, I'm not getting it done. I'm not good enough. There's something wrong with me. Or like, why is this taking so long? You're like, oh, I've been carrying 8 projects. And remember, projects are anything that require time, energy, and attention, which means like moving, getting married, going on that vacation. Like I wrote a post the other day about like why the summer is surprisingly so busy for people. Right. And because we have this mindset that even that work slows down.
Right.
Right. And we go into the summer. But what people don't think about is for many of them, kids come home. And kids create their own projects, right? They take up some of them 5 projects, right? And getting them from school, getting them transitioned into summer mode, and then getting them to all the camps and all the things that they might do, or figuring out babysitters, and then getting them back to school. Like in my lexicon, those all count as projects.
Yeah.
So that means most parents go into August or early September, and guess what? They don't have 5 project slots they can choose. They have at most 4.
Yeah.
Because getting the kids reacclimating is a project.
I love that. I love that you broke it down like that. And it's funny because I was thinking about this and I was like, okay, you know what? Like I'm actually looking at Notion right now as we're speaking just to kind of see. And I was like, okay, you know what? I have it set up into, you know, sort of I've categorized it by the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, which basically is all the content related to this, whether it's, you know, blog posts, animation, you know, newsletters, all that lives under one project. And then I have a section called Special Projects where it's, you know, speaking engagements, you know, the conference we're planning, and then, you know, the project that's in the pit, which we'll get to in a second. But so I think there's one other thing about this. You know, you brought up the five project rule. I think that there were these five keys that you highlighted at the very beginning of the book: intention, awareness, boundaries, courage, and discipline. Can you take us there and you know, explain to us the role that they play in a project?
Yeah. So these are the five keys to doing your best work. I would also call them the five keys to thriving, but that's because I see best work and thriving is so intimately linked that they do the same thing.
Yeah.
Right. And so as a mnemonic, if you're listening, guys, it's IABCD, intention, awareness, boundaries, courage, and discipline. These are the five keys that when you really look at projects that are stuck, what I've noticed is that it's some combination of not enough of one of those in the project, right? And I'm just going to call out for most of us creative people, it's actually courage and discipline that we need a lot more of. And I know I'm an Army guy and you're going to think, yeah, that's great for you. But no, seriously, like the discipline to choose a limited number of things that you want to be masterful at, that's a discipline, right? And the discipline to set out the goals of doing that and then sort of establishing the boundaries, it takes a little bit of discipline to establish and keep boundaries. Like that's where so much of the magic happens. And I think whenever I get a chance to be, you know, that version of you at the party with a novel writer, what I always want to prompt people is just to think like, you know, take whatever project you're thinking about or maybe that you're stuck. And there's two questions I'd like to ask. One is, what's the smartest next step? And the second is, what's the most courageous next step?
That's a lot more polite than saying that's complete bullshit.
Hey, man, we talked about why I got to do it that way, right? I'm serious, though, like, because I have a military brand and people like, you know, they hold that. If I say something super hard, people are like, man, he yelled at me when he said it was bullshit. I was like, Srini said the same thing. It's just he's surfer, bro. Right. And but if I say it, I'm a drill sergeant. What the hell, man? But anyway, so I asked those two questions because it turns out that the smartest next step is almost always the most courageous next step. Because no one changes the world, whether you want to think about that big or small, by just taking smart moves. Like you got to introduce some courage there. And so when in my own work, in my own practice, I, you know, at the end of the day, I'm like, how many courage points did I put on the board today? Right. I don't care how smart I am. Right. It comes down to how much I actually leaned out there and did something that made me super uncomfortable. So those are the five keys. You know, I'm sorry, I sort of got off on that. Those five keys, when you look at the project that you're stuck, do you have the intention? Like, do you know what you want? Do you have a strong feeling about where you want that to go? Awareness is, do you really know what's going on with that project, with yourself, with your context? Boundaries are, have you set up the right positive and negative boundaries that allow you to focus on that thing and keep other things out? Courage is, are you actually showing up and making those unsafe but long-term smarter choices? And discipline is, are you following through? And then one thing I'm going to say here, this is a kind of aside, but so many people get stuck because they confuse their desire for certainty with their desire for clarity, right? And I just bring this up because so many people are like, well, I'm going to wait till I get clear about what I should be doing. Yeah. And when you really ask a few questions underneath, what they're really saying is, I'm not sure that this is going to work, and I'm going to wait until I find a pathway that I'm pretty sure is going to work before I move. That's a different conversation than whether, you know, you're clear about it. Because a lot of times when it comes to the projects that matter most, I call those best work projects. It's clear what you need to do. It's uncertain whether it's going to be successful. And people conflate the two of them and get themselves stuck.
Interesting. So I'll walk you through the pit, the project we say is in the pit. You know, I'm not a person who has trouble shipping. You know that. You know my work. You know, when I tell you I will get you something, you'll get it when I say you'll get it. So, you know, Audience of One came out. I'd already started mapping out, you know, proposal for my next book. Like literally the day I submitted the manuscript, I think even before that, I'd already started mapping this out. I was like, okay. And we went through, so we went through a dozen revisions. Like, you know, my agent would send it back with comments. I would go to, you know, the guy that I hired to help me with the book proposal. We would shape it some more. Then we'd send it back. And I think I was the last round of comments that I got. And I let it sit, you know, I went and reviewed it. I let it sit for a month. And I just, And no matter how much I would open it up and I would look at it. And then some, I don't know what it was. Like, I think I finally got to the point where I was like, okay, you know what? I need to just open this thing every day and just at least, you know, give it a read to see if something comes to me. But it's the first time that I ever, and I think it was partially because we had gone through so many revisions and I didn't have to do any of this the first time I got a book deal. Mm-hmm. And I was getting really frustrated because I was like, it's been 9 months and, mm-hmm. you know, and it's, you know, I think the other part of it is that there is literally no guarantee that it will lead to a book deal.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. So how do I get unstuck using what you've talked about here? And what do you notice about what I'm saying that so far based on our conversation is the issue?
Part of it may be a discipline piece. Like what I tagged on was there at the end when you said, this is the first time that I've had to do this much. I'm reinterpreting. This is the first time I've had to work so hard to get this done. Right. Mm-hmm. With all the commentary and feedback, so on and so forth. Right. So I'd say that there's probably something there. I'll ask three questions real quick.
Okay.
Do you want the outcome of the project, whatever that might be?
You mean the finished book or the book deal with the publisher? Book,
whatever you think that's going to do. Like, do you want the finished, do you want to be at the end destination?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. So that's great. Two, mm-hmm. what do you think you're going to have to give up to get there?
So this is kind of funny for me. So like when I look at the discipline issue, I kind of wonder if it's a discipline about working on this one thing, because, you know, I wake up and I write every day. It's just that I don't write this, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah.
And that's where I'm kind of like, where is the conflict going on here? Like, is it a discipline of that's why I don't necessarily agree that it's a discipline issue. I think it's something else.
Okay. So I'm going to approach this way. Like, we don't need an accountability buddy or a productivity system to eat ice cream.
Yeah.
Right. Or to have sex. Sure. Like those are things we want to do. There's instant feedback. There's all sorts of reasons why we want to do those things. Right.
Mm.
And so when people start procrastinating and put off projects, I always try to find where there's a misalignment. Right.
Mm.
And so my first question was really like, is there a misalignment between what you actually want and the goal? Right. And it doesn't seem that there is. Right. The second misalignment is we often tell ourselves some version of a no-win scenario, and I'm trying to figure out what your no-win scenario might be, but sometimes it has the formula of to do X, I had to give up Y that means something that really matters to me, right? That's the story that we sort of propagate, and then we won't do X because we don't want to let go of Y, right? And so I think if we were to hang out there, I think for you, what it is for me to finish this book, I have to give up the flexibility of writing whatever the hell I want to write about and instead focus that time on writing on this book.
Yeah.
And so I lose my ability to go with the flow and surf the creative wave and just be out there swimming laps. And I don't want to do that. Like, I want to be surfing the creative wave right now.
Yeah. Whereas this is, I have to sit here belaboring, looking at this thing, you know, resisting the temptation to throw my laptop against the wall and let it shatter into a million pieces.
Yeah.
But this is apparently not uncommon. Like, I was talking to Cal about this and he was like, you spend 9 months on this. He's like, he's like, you know, apparently this is very common among first time authors who get their book deals because you get known for this one thing you've done and you're kind of like, okay, cool. And now you're having to basically sort of reinvent yourself and show that, hey, wait a minute, I can do this again and I can do it in a different way.
Yeah. Well, and that's the sort of third no-win scenario that I write about in the book is that like the what if I can't do it again trap, right?
Uh-huh.
What if I got this book deal and I had this creative muse and it was great and it did what it did, but what if I can't do that again? Like, mm-hmm. or what if my next book isn't as good as my first book? Or what if my next book is better than my first book? What's that say about my first? Like, we tell ourselves all sorts of stories like that. That, you know, it's the thrashing that I talk about in the book, right? The thrashing is the meta work and the flailing that you do around the work, but it's not actually pushing the work forward. It's just a bunch of emotional labor that doesn't get you anywhere, right? And so I would say just based upon this project, I think you probably have that no-win scenario of like you have to give up something that's important to you. And the second one of like, what if I can't do it again? Or, you know, what if the magic doesn't come together? And I think, as I've been thinking about, I've worked with a lot of authors here, Serenity, and we all have different creative pulses. And unfortunately, we try to put ourselves in some other pulse that may not be our own. I mean, I mentioned earlier that I'm a once every 5 years book guy. Well, I might be a once every 3 years book guy because I know for me, that's just the pace at which things accrete and incubate and sort of come together that I feel like I have the book. And if I tried to do that every year, it feels like, you know, a Brazilian jiu-jitsu match with a spider monkey where I will lose half of the, like, at least half of the matches. Right. Yeah. Because I just don't have, I don't have that strong backbone of a body of work or a solid idea that gets me up. And I worked with another client on this, and you actually know who he is. And he hit this pit in the writing part of the in sort of the drafting part. So I'll focus this. Like, when we look at creative projects, there are different phases of it. Like, there's that first 20% that some people really gig about, like get in on, and some people it terrifies them. Then there's the last 20% where you run out of creative room and you have to start like finishing the house that you've built instead of keep adding more and more rooms to it. Right. And then there's that middle 60%, right, where you still have a lot of room to play and you're not looking at the white screen. But we all struggle in different places and different reasons with those sort of things, right?
Yeah.
And so this other guy I was talking about, he reached a point to where he lost the magic. Sometimes it's called the golden thread that keeps you in that work. And I just straight up told him, I was like, you can sit down every day to write this book. And this doesn't contradict what you told homegirl at the party. Right. But I said, the reason you sit down is so that you find that golden thread again, you find that magic again, because if you can't find it, you're not going to finish this book. But it's not necessarily going to come to you in the way that you think it's going to. It's not like one day you're like, I'm going to take a week off. And then a week later, you're going to feel like writing. Usually what happens is you get pissed off because you're about to get laughed by somebody else writing what you think is your book. Uh-huh. And then you're like, oh crap, I got to get to it. Right. And so it's like, it doesn't have to be painful, but that discipline of sitting there and finding the magic, finding the curiosity, finding the golden thread, you know, to, you know, sort of riff off your book, create yourself as the own audience of one and get back to it. If you can't do that, you're not going to finish the book, but you have to create those conditions. Those conditions do not happen on their own. Does that help?
Yeah, that helps tremendously. I mean, it's funny because even the first major breakthrough I had on the book came when I spent, you know, a month and a half, almost a month in India, just kind of hanging out with family. And I was still writing every day. I woke up and I did this. It was kind of like, okay, so I'm writing at this point with no idea where any of this is leading. But bit by bit, it all just started coming together, you know, to get past the next hurdle. And then, of course, you know, the next hurdle basically came here recently, which was this latest round. And I was like, okay, you know what? I have, you know, it's like, I got other fish to fry right now too. And that was kind of like, okay, you know what? I need to go in and deal with, you know, other, you know, it's like, okay, you know what? I want to work on growing the podcast just as much. But like I said, I mean, I've limited it down to three projects. This is the one that I can't get myself to really push it as much as I can on all the others. But enough about me. I want to, you know, I think we use that as an example mainly because, gave us something concrete, but there's another part of this that you mentioned, and I want to tackle it from a, you know, a different angle. So you talk about SMART goals, but I think that the way that you actually went about this is very different than I've ever heard it explained. I think the things that struck me were you talking about finish and start dates, which I thought, you know what, I'm like, I should do that. I should actually put finish and start dates on things. So let's start there.
Yeah, finish and start dates. I think we do ourselves not enough favors when it comes to finish dates, but there's some power to those start dates, right? And so obviously, I don't have to explain what start and finish dates are, but the reason they're so powerful is because it creates space for us to finish what we're already working on and to not put the additional pressure. And so to say, you know, hey, I'm going to start this project on August 13th, right? You can start to sequence everything else up around like, okay, I've got to finish this. I've got to clear the deck. I got to get rid of this other project that I got because I don't have any room for this one. And when you commit to start dates, especially publicly, right, or to people who are in what I call your success pack, it also creates that new slice of time. It's like the difference between when you've been just sort of dating someone or you've been sort of co-living with someone for a long time versus when you propose marriage, right? There's a date that happens when you get married that's a shift in that relationship, right? And I think putting start dates on projects creates that sort of thing. And just from a pure logistical perspective, if you look at whatever system you use to track start dates and you see, wait a second, I'm starting 17 things that week. Maybe you can make some better choices about that. Like, I'm not going to finish 17 things that week. I'm going to finish 3 to 5, right? So how am I going to deconflict and how I'm going to sequence that? And it just helps you avoid some of those cascades at the same time that it helps you avoid things remaining in someday maybe land forever. Just because you have to like move the date and you have to talk about it and so on and so forth. So start dates, super, super powerful. Now the trick here is I'm all about chunking projects down into human understandable things. So I just talked about that with the five projects rule. So I wouldn't say, you know, if we're talking, actually, I really loved hanging out with your book project, Srini, because I love the grip of it. So I'm just going to hang out there until you tell me to let it go. But instead of saying like start the book on August 13th, right? It would be create the table of contents or to start, you know, the research list or however you start your project. It would be that small enough chunk that when that day came, it wouldn't be like, oh man, I got to start the book and what am I doing? And I, all the stuff is like, can you start the lit review or can or not? Can you start the table of content or not? Is it something you can do in a focus block, 90 to 120 minutes where you focus on it or not? Right. And I think that's the gift of really displacement, i.e. that sense of we only have so much time, energy, and attention, is that when we chunk things down to match the time perspective that we have, we can look at it on a given day and say, do I have time to start my table of contents? Yes or no, right? And if you don't, then you don't necessarily have to beat yourself up. Like you can say, no, I don't, but I'm going to move this other thing, right? I want people to go into really black and white yes or no questions or yes or no answers to some of these. Do I have time or not? Yes, no. Yeah. If no, then I can do X. Because I look at it, probably that military background, it's just, it's an obstacle. We got to go over, around, under, or through. There's only four ways to get around an obstacle here, right? Which of those are you going to do? Instead of just looking at the obstacle and being like, you know what? Not even going to think about it. I'm going to walk away. Because you know what? The next time you come to it, it's still going to be there.
Yeah.
And not only will the obstacle be there, your story about that obstacle will have grown. Like that dragon, I like to call those obstacle dragons. That dragon gets bigger and more lethal and more and scarier the more that it can just sit over there on the side and grow and accrete. And it's not the dragon that's done anything. It's your story about it, right?
Yeah. It's funny you say that, you know, so I mentioned to you, we're planning this conference in April, and it's funny because that is literally the approach that I was taking. Because I realized, I was like, okay, there's probably like 200 things that I have to do. And I literally have boiled it down to the simplest like things. It's like send an email to the speakers to confirm, connect Stripe to the website for the thing. And it was like one little thing every day. And I thought about it. I was like, okay, you know what? This is going to take like 200 or 300 to-do lists, but I have until April. So like, you know, it's like, okay, what can I do today to move this thing forward? And I realized it almost like most days so far, like we've written, you know, the website, we've connected MailChimp, we've confirmed with all the speakers, all of that happened over about 3 weeks. You know, it was like, we picked a location, you know, all that. And it was, and when I looked at it, I was like, oh wow, I'm just doing one small thing every day.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is, you know, when you look at your best work projects, those are ones that are going to take multiple quarters to see through. Mm-hmm. And this is where sort of that discipline and those boundaries, and that's why you have to keep coming back to it. Because, you know, if it's just a week size project, like just pure inspiration and, you know, caffeine and a little bit of creativity can get you through that project that week, right? Yeah. But you can't do that for 37 weeks, right? And, well, I mean, some people can, but it's super hard to do that, right? Of just fuel and, you know, caffeine, inspiration, and a little bit of intelligence. Like, you can't do that. You got to structure it in the way that we're talking about and create those boundaries and create those plans and take those steps. But any work that matters is just a series of small steps. It's like that Henry Ford statement, like, you know, nothing, what is it?
I know what you're talking about.
there's one, I'm not going to butcher it, but to make a point, like anything, everything is just a series of small steps, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's, you know, that, you know, 12-mile ruck march where you got the backpack on, you've got your machine gun, you're going, like, it's step by step by step, leg by leg by leg. That's on the military side of things. If you're exercising, dieting, doing creative work, it's really step by step. And Serena, I laugh about this because you know how there are some people whose work is sort of Instagram friendly? Yeah. Like they can go out and they do all sort of things. Like if you really look at my work, it would look like a lot of sitting at the coffee shop writing. Like it's so unsexy. Right. When you think about what it actually takes to finish books and do work, it's like a lot of sitting there looking at a damn screen like that.
Yeah.
Who gives a crap? Of course, I might be able to write about the beautiful environment that I'm in.
Yeah.
Or excuse me, post about it. But I'm like, that's not interesting. Like what I want people to really embrace is the beauty and sacredness of the work they're doing when it's their best work, and sort of embrace that thrashing, that difficulty, that Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and know, you know, Srini, there were so many times where I was writing this, and I wrote this on an Alpha Smart Neo, so you'll have to Google it, right? But it's like a late 1990s word processor with an LCD screen, five lines, no internet, anything like that. And there were so parts of writing this book that were so challenging for me that and because I'm a writer, Srini, you'll know what I mean here. I can hear the space between a paragraph when I'm drafting. There's a feeling, you know, that there's something there. And if I was writing on a modern laptop with access to all the things, I know that I would be off chasing what's on YouTube or seeing what Srini's doing or what's on Twitter, what's on email. Like, any of that actually matters, but I would do it anyways, because that's where I would feel that tug. I would hear that space.
Yeah.
But on the Neo, I was like, I can't do any of that. So my options are, do I want to quit writing or am I going to continue writing? And most of the time it was, you know, sort of channeling Liz Gilbert on this one, go back in. Yeah. No matter how difficult it was, go back in, like take a few more knots, do a few more roll arounds with the spider monkey, right? Until something came out, right? But I knew that I had to set that up, because otherwise when it got hard, I'd be like, you know what? This is hard right now. I'm going to go see what my team needs me to do, as opposed to doing the thing that my team really needed me to do, which was finish the damn book.
So I think the two other things that really struck me when you got into SMART goals were, you talked about these three types of successes. Now, is that what we're talking about when we're finishing these small things like moderate, small, and epic, or is that different? Or are we talking about outcomes there?
Talking more about outcomes when it comes to the three levels of success. And so those three levels were epic success, or if you're not a millennial, you can say extreme. It's all good.
Yeah.
Right. Moderate success and small success. Now, the thing about it is moderate success is that level of success where you're great about it, but it's the furthest that you can take yourself, or you can take that project by yourself. Mm-hmm. And the reason I wanted to talk about levels of success is because we too often either aren't clear about what level of success we're after, or we're not matching the level of success we're after with the level of effort that we're putting in.
Yeah.
And so too many people want epic results, but they're not putting in epic effort. And very rarely does that actually pan out for folks, right? And so the grace here, and again, so much of my work is about choosing from the beginning what game you're playing, so that as you're playing that game, you don't beat yourself up because you think you should be playing another game. Like, no, this is the game that you chose.
Yeah.
It's like completely great to choose a small success on something, right? It's like, that's what you want to do. Maybe it's a practice project. Maybe it's just something you want to do, but you know what? The results don't matter nearly as much as you just finishing the damn thing. Small success is great. Moderate success is great too. What I will tell people is, if you want epic success, and I'll just use a book example, like if you want to hit the bestseller list, you've got to put in some, you know, epic level effort to match that. And you can't achieve epic success by yourself. If whatever success that you've generated could have been generated just by yourself, at best, it's moderate success at best. Yeah. But you got to build a pack. You've got to build people around you to have success at the level, you know. And epic is like that Oprah moment. I know she's no longer on the air, but like, you know, you get that call and it's like, I'm going to be on the Oprah show, like that level. You know, where no matter what you're doing, you pick up the phone, call your mama, that sort of scenario. Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't happen on its own. It happens after a combination of really, you know, using the five keys I mentioned earlier, being super intentional about where you're trying to go and building a pack of people around you to help get you there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, you don't build SpaceX by just being Elon Musk. Like, it's an army of people that makes that happen. I think that, I talked to Justine Musk about this whole epic, or, you know, what she calls extreme success, right? Where we're talking like Richard Branson, Elon, you know, Jeff Bezos level. And there are a lot of interesting things about that conversation. One of which, you know, she said, one, she's like, I don't think people really understand how much work goes into these kinds of accomplishments. And she said, I also don't think they see that these things usually come at the cost of everything else in your life. Like, if this is what you want, there is a price to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I want to be careful here.
Yeah.
Because there are so many stories that we hang on to around the valor of the struggle the valor of it being hard. And why I want to be careful here is because when you're already prone for perfectionism, when you're already prone for certain types of ways of excellence, unfortunately, you'll choose things, you'll choose to do things in ways that make it harder than it needs to be because there's value in the difficulty, right?
Yeah.
And at the same time, the level of long, like decades long, multiple decades long focus that it takes to accrue the type of success that you're talking about there, yeah, it does wear on relationships. Yeah, it does wear on bodies. It wears on souls and things like that. So I think there's an and there that I want to say, like, yes, it's going to require you to be incredibly disciplined. It's going to require you to have a lot of boundaries, a lot of courage, a lot of things like that.
Yeah.
And just be careful that you're not reading more into the difficulty of the struggle and you're not sort of lionizing that difficulty, because otherwise your life is going to be unnecessarily hard.
Yeah. Wow. So you've alluded to the success packs multiple times. We haven't actually gotten into where they are, and you break it down into four groups of people: guides, peers, supporters, and beneficiaries. So can you define who those are, who those people are, and what role they each play?
Sure. Guides are people who are at a level of mastery and a level of character that can inform your project, that you can ask questions. So these are your Yodas, your Gandalfs, your Morpheuses, right? That really can guide the project. But the thing about it is, guides can be incredibly frustrating, because they say cryptic things like use the force, or, you know, be yourself. And you're like, what the hell does that mean?
Yeah.
Like, it never is apparent what they're saying until that particular moment. Right. So if you're into Joseph Campbell, there's sort of that sage that gives you that thing that you need, but you often don't understand it when you first get it. Mm-hmm. And they don't work in the projects with you. Right. So, you know, your guide is probably not going to unlock the doors that you think that guide is going to unlock. Right. And so, but guides are really important, because their main job is to shift your worldview and the way you see the world just enough that you can get out of the holes that you crawl into, and keep yourself into.
Yeah.
Which, I'm going to pause here, because oftentimes we don't realize, because of blind spots and because of all sorts of other head trash that we have, we don't realize the degree to which we're keeping ourselves in the hole that we're complaining about being stuck in. Right. And your guides are those people that basically point out, it's like, you know, you have what you need to get out of that hole if you use it.
Yeah.
If you don't want to use it, maybe there's something about hanging out in that hole that's really important to you.
So this is so weird. I mean, I think maybe I just noticed patterns, because these are things that are going on in my own life. But I had a mentor who was, you know, everybody who has listened to the show has heard, he's been a guest on the podcast. He came up with the name Unmistakable Creative, Greg Hartle. And I remember we had a year that was amazing, and then that was followed by a very, very difficult year. You know, he was, you know, very ill, like, basically given a nine month to live period. Fortunately, he's still alive. But, you know, I was going through a personally rough patch during that. And he hammered me. I mean, it was one of those periods of, you know, just beating on me endlessly. And, you know, I thought, this is just so frustrating. I'm like, I'm, you know, sad, I'm depressed, like, you know, I had a breakup, whatever. And I think what he was really doing was drilling into me this idea of real mental toughness, because, you know, so that when the stakes were higher, I wouldn't end up in that same situation again. And I realized how, literally it's been, I think, 4 or 5 years since, you know, I'd worked together with him in any capacity. And that came full circle just a few weeks ago, when I had a disappointing experience in my personal life. And, you know, I thought, you know what, I don't have the luxury of not being on my game here. And I realized, I was like, wow, that's a lesson from almost 5 years ago.
Absolutely. And you couldn't have understood it at that time.
No, I saw it as a mentor who was being cruel.
Yeah. And so mentors and guides have that sort of way. I'm super fortunate, you know, having gone through the military experience, that drill sergeants are often those first guides that hammer all sorts of stuff into you that just irritate you. But then, you know, sort of my military experience is the same way. Like, right now when things are super hard, I'm like, I'm not getting shot at today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's like, I'm going to live today. Unless something really freaky happens. I've been in situations where that hasn't always been clear. And so whatever I'm going through right now, like, at least I'm not getting shot at. It's difficult, but I can and will get through this. Which is such a different perspective than like the, oh, it's super hard right now. I don't know what I'm going to do. Am I going to make it? Of course you're going to freaking make it. Right. Mm-hmm. It might not look the way, but yeah, mentors and guides have that sort of aspect on that. And what's important, I mentioned character there because there are all sorts of ways that people achieve certain types of results that may not be in alignment with who you are. Mm-hmm. And following someone, you putting them as a guide when you have that character dissonance is only going to make your life worse. So find people that whose character and integrity you can respect and use them as guides, as opposed to people who you're always going to be like, yeah, but they're saying this, but is that really true? Like, do I have to do what they're telling me to do? Like, that doesn't feel right for me.
Yeah.
All right. So there's the guides. Peers are people that are about your same level of accomplishment, the same level of perspective. These are people that you can ask, you know, sort of as you're going. These might be your co-coaches. These might be your co-mentors. These might be your mastermind buddies. It could be that friend that you meet with every once in a while and talk about how things are going and get feedback on. But you can reasonably expect them to have good perspective on your project and to be involved in different ways, but they're not guides, but they're not supporters either, which supporters are the people that are actively involved in building the project with you. Could be teammates, professional teammates, could be the neighbor kid that watches your kids on the weekend so that you can focus on your work on that free Saturday that you've got. Like, it can be all sorts of people. It can be your partner. It could be your parents. You'd be the librarian. Whoever is instrumental in supporting you can be there. And the last one, like if any of the groups of people are more important than others, I would always have to say the beneficiaries. And these are the people who benefit because you've completed your work. Like when you do work in the world, there's only one of two things that generate, sometimes a combination of those. You either solve a problem or you deliver a delight. You solve a problem or you deliver a delight for someone. Your beneficiaries are those someones. And why they're so important is like when you get stuck and you're not sure about your project and which way to go, like you can do that, you know, really simple, but sometimes difficult thing of asking that beneficiary, like, is this working? How does this work for you? Did this do what I was trying to do with it? And you can like have that real conversation and get that feedback from the world and from that person about how you're doing. Second reason is super important is because though people can sometimes give up on themselves, it's really hard to give up on other people and to let other people down.
Yeah.
And so having a beneficiary who you've told, hey, I'm going to have this thing done in 3 months. You might be halfway through those 3 months and you sort of know at the end of that person's going to be expecting you to do that. You said you were going to do that. In some ways, your identity, your integrity is on the line. And sometimes that's just enough to get you, you know, to sit down one more time or to go back in one more time, because it's not just about you and what you want to do. It's about this commitment to this other person that you've made. And you know what? At a certain point, don't care about your feelings, right? Mm-hmm. Care about what you're doing, how you're making the world better, and how you're going to look back at that particular project and that relationship and say, you know what? It was hard, but I did the work that mattered, and I'm super proud of that. Mm.
So I think that there are two sort of last pieces of this. You talked about a pre-mortem, which is one of those things that, you know, I don't think enough people do. And I often, you know, look back and like, why the hell didn't we do this? Like, we could have prevented this. And then there's, of course, the aspect of actually mapping it out and you go into chunking and all of that. So can you kind of walk us through both of those? Because I think they're both kind of tied together.
So a pre-mortem is what we sound like. You think about all the different ways that your project may go sideways, all the different challenges that may come up. Now, I want to pause here because sometimes people have the idea that like if you speak to a challenge, you make the challenge stronger.
Right.
Right. Like you assert that it's like it's some sort of self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, I think that's new age bullshit personally, but that's...
I do too. It's like if I talk about gravity, it makes gravity stronger. No, it doesn't. Gravity is going to be there whether you're talking about it. So sure, don't talk about gravity and jump off the building. That's going to go well for you. Right. And so... But I want to at least put that out there because there's some people like, oh, but I don't want to sort of wallow in all the ways that something can go wrong. I want to look at it more like this. Like, look, whatever you're like, there is a physics of getting stuff done in the sense that there are just forces in the world, internal and external, that are going to weigh in on your project.
Yeah.
It's just reasonable to say, you know, it's not about me. It's about those forces and how I can overcome those forces so that I could design my project so that they do overcome them. Just like aeronautical engineers have to design planes to overcome drag. They're not like, oh, if we talk about drag, it makes it worse. Like, no, we have to design wings that overcome this, right? Yeah. And so I mean, we're laughing, but it's a serious thing that can get people tripped up. Mm-hmm. So it's just going through that and then having a proactive response to each one of those. So if you know you're bad at discipline,
yeah,
right, you can put in steps. Maybe you need an accountability buddy. Maybe mm-hmm. you need to figure out a way that doesn't require you to do discipline or use as much discipline. Maybe you could think about how you make it more like ice cream or sex, right? So that you want to do it, right? So that's the pre-mortem side of things. Mm-hmm. We've mentioned chunking projects in the sense of always breaking it down into smaller parts, because I think that's where people get overwhelmed. It's like, you know, we started this talking about 3 to 5 year like meta projects, and like that seems super overwhelming. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, and I didn't mention this at the time because I was like, oh, that may get us somewhere. But one of the simplest things that we can do for ourselves to make our world make our work easier to do is when you create an action list for yourself, like a to-do list for today, mm-hmm. only list chunks of the project that are relevant for that day or that you know you can get done in a day. Because when you look at people's to-do lists, Randy, you'll see like write chapter 2. Send an email to John, call the IRS, like deposit money, you know, finish backyard project. And it's like, wait a second. So one's like 2 months, one's a 1 month project, one's a day long project, and your brain's trying to figure out how to make that work. So it's just as simple sometimes as saying, you know what, today is just going to be things that are either, I'm super rigid about sort of the focus blocks and sort of the, you know, things like that. But if you just quantize your day mm-hmm. such that it's either a 2 hour chunk or a 15-minute task, which sending that email, probably going to be 15 minutes, whether you want to fight me on it or not, right? On average, it's going to be about that long. So you can just look and say, okay, I have 6 hours of work that I can do today. I can do that in two-hour chunks. So what does that feel like? And then I can send maybe, you know, 8 emails. And that's your to-do list. So when you look at that task, it's not like, oh crap, how am I going to fit that in? Where am I going to do this? What's the next chunk? Because you just do what's on the piece of paper because it fits the time perspective that you're looking at. Does that make sense, Rini?
Yeah. That makes all the sense in the world. I mean, I have a thing called daily action steps in my Notion, and it's, I mean, there's no question that makes all the sense in the world because I'm like, okay, what can I realistically do today? And that is, you know, it's funny because despite how productive I usually am, I still run. And part of the reason I spend so much time, you know, exploring these kinds of topics is because, like, you know, I am constantly looking for ways to improve my own process.
Absolutely. I think we all are. I mean, you know, I joke with Mike Vardy because we have a lot of productivity gyms. And the fact of the matter is at a certain point, we're kind of lazy. And we are always looking for how can we get the same amount of work done with less effort? And it's true, right? This is straight up true. And so even to your point, like when I create my daily list, I won't go too much into this, but like, I know that by 11 o'clock, about 20% of the things I put on there, I'm just not going to do, right? Mm-hmm. And so I write them in pencil, so I just erase those things. And then I put one on what I've actually done. And you're like, why do you do that? It's because I don't need those things I know I'm not going to be able to do to haunt me for the rest of the day. Mm-hmm. The game is already set. I know that, right? So just stop committing Ben with it and try to do a little bit better tomorrow. And that's the name of the game here.
Well, I think that really kind of makes a perfect place to bring us full circle and wrap up a conversation that has been wide ranging and taken us in many different directions, but for good reason. I mean, this has been fascinating, eye-opening, insightful. So I want to finish with my final question, which I know you've heard me ask before. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Off the top of my head, I'm going to say when it's clear how much courage it took to create it.
Amazing. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and to share your stories, your insights, and to subject yourself to my questions that had absolutely nothing to do with your book for 30 minutes. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything else that you're up to?
All right. So you can find out more about me at productiveflourishing.com. And if you're interested in the book, it's at startfinishingbook.com. You can get a free chapter. It shows a little bit more about what it's about. And by the way, Srini, like the parts where we weren't talking about the book, equally as fun for me. So I appreciate that part of the conversation as much as the latter part.
Yeah, I mean, those are some of my favorite parts anyways. So, you know, and for everybody listening, we'll wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming. Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.